pretty well, and we're on quite cordial terms and help each other out and whatnot as we can. But I learned very early on that there were certain things that it's probably not worth discussing, namely religion and politics. So we talk a lot about the weather, and we talk about, you know, really local issues that are going on and whatnot. Because otherwise, my function in going down to the San Luis Valley is not to consider my part-time neighbors to come around to my point of view. So we agreed to make that kind of a space between us, a kind of a demilitarized zone. But after coming back from that, I just finished doing a 3-day retreat that I helped organize, that I have been over the last year or so, it's a reunion retreat and in-service training retreat of Dharma teachers that I trained with in my seminary program 20 years ago at Spirit Rock. And each of us now does something like, you know, what I'm doing here, serve as a guiding teacher for a local Sangha. David Chernikoff and Terry Ray were both members of the charter class of that seminary program as well. And so each year we choose a theme to organize the retreat around, and this year I was on the program committee that developed it. And so we came up with the theme a year ago at our meeting in Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. And we decided that we wanted to do a convocation organized on the theme of the Buddhist response to the climate change and the climate emergency and climate justice. And there is a very well-known Buddhist scholar who is also a biological scientist, a woman named Stephanie Kaza. She's written really extensively on this topic. And so she was there, and she gave teachings on both mornings. And then Mary Aubrey, another CDL alum, and I took turns leading the sits. And then we would listen to Stephanie I give teachings and then spend time discussing them. And of course, we organized this program prior to the contagion, COVID-19 coming out, and prior to the events leading up to our nation's dramatic encounter with social injustice. And so while we had thought about originally getting together just to talk about climate change and how the Dharma might be brought to bear on it, what we realized instead is that there is this huge range of challenges that we are facing along with that. And so some of the time we spent talking together was on reflecting on whether or not there might be a unifying principle that that sort of ties them all together, or that bespeaks a very clear relationship among them from the perspective of the Dharma. And so, and I was on this retreat until not long before I'm with you all now, which is my excuse for not having actually finished writing my Dharma talk. So what I want to do is crowdsource the end of my Dharma talk. I want to present my thoughts as they're coming together after this retreat, and what I see sort of the threads to be. And then I'd really appreciate, you know, just doing some idea mongering around that, and so that's what I have in mind for us to spend our time together doing after we set. So let's do that first, so we'll have something to talk about. So let's settle in and find our sitting posture. And as we know, it doesn't matter if you're sitting, you know, on a chair or a cushion or a bench or lying down for that matter. But what we know really facilitates this practice, enables us to do it well, is to attend to two things. The first is to check in with the body and ensure that we're sitting in a way that is a genuine kindness to the body, so that we can be relaxed and at ease and centered and yet still awake and alert. So check your posture and make sure you're sitting upright with your head up, shoulders back. So the chest is opened up a little bit, allowing the breathing to become a little deeper, a little gentler, perhaps, with slower. Arms relaxed at your sides and your hands folded in your lap, or perhaps resting on your legs. And then allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether you notice your breathing mostly as the air moving in and out the nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. Not seeking to force the breath to be any special way, but simply allowing into the experience of knowing the body breathing itself, knowing whether you're breathing a long breath or a short one, a deep breath or a shallow one, a rapid breath or a slow one. Simply allowing the body to find a form of breathing that centers in on, relaxes to, into its own natural pace and depth and rhythm.
All sentient beings have happiness and the root of happiness. May we be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May we never be separated from the highest bliss, which is without suffering. May we come to rest limitlessly, which is without aversion.
By attending to the breathing, we can expand our field of awareness to take in not only the breathing, but also bodily sensations and sounds and thoughts and emotions. Allowing whatever becomes the mind's predominant object of attention at any moment in time, to likewise become the object of meditation. Watching each of these phenomena in their turn, as they arise and change and pass away, like fluffy white clouds moving across a deep blue sky. Okay, welcome back. Does anyone have any Dharma-related announcements that they'd like to share at this point in time?
I
Well, there, don't see much going on here.
I actually have one if no one else does.
Okay, please, Kathleen.
Or even if someone else has one. Aya Damodira is going to be speaking with us next week from the Mahapajapati Monastery that she's now heading. And I'm sure everything will go fine, but it will be a first time event trying it from there. So let's just be prepared. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay, good. Anything else from anybody? Well, one of the topics about which there was a lot of buzz at this retreat that I just came off of was the publication of Isabel Wilkerson's book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. And I'm about a third of the way through it now. And I think it's going to be a real game changer. I think it's going to it presents the potential for doing some major relanguaging of interethnic relations in our country. She seldom uses the word race in the book. It's very interesting. She talks a lot about ethnic lineage and its relationship to socioeconomic status in this country. And it's just incredibly rich. And so one of the things that occurred to me is if there are enough people in the Sangha who are likewise interested in reading it, maybe a couple of weeks out or so, for those who might wish to, we could put together, a little reading group, a study group around that specific text and how we see the Buddha Dharma perhaps relating to some of the issues that are raised there. One of the conversations I actually got sort of started at this retreat is what would it look like if we had an early Buddhist liberation theology, kind of like the Catholic liberation theology in Latin America. And it seems to me that that's a topic that's worth investigation, right? So if there are others who are also interested in exploring these ideas in this text, then maybe about a week or so out from now, when those who maybe acquire the book or are thinking about acquiring the book and would like to read it with others, discuss it with others, from a Dharma perspective, then I can sort of put the word out. Those who are interested, I could host a little Zoom meeting around that for those who might want to do that. So, there's that. Anything else?
Yes, I have one thing, Luke.
Please, Luke. Yeah.
If someone is interested in a study group on the myth of freedom, the way of meditation by Chogyam Trungpa, my teacher, Murshida Rudy Cotter, will be doing a study group starting Thursday nights. So I'll just put my contact information. So if anyone's interested, contact me. It's a very, it's a great book. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I read it, I think, quite a long time ago when I was just starting to make the transition from Vajrayana to Theravada practice. And then, Trump is a great communicator. He really had this intuitive sense of how to address the American mind.
Yes, you, I read it a long time ago, so I forgot.
Yeah. Okay, super. Okay, anything else? Well, like I said, this retreat that I helped organize and it just came off of for the last 3 days was, of course, organized around one theme, which is Buddhist response to climate emergency and climate justice. And then, of course, along came the contagion, along came the slow, sadistic killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis that turned out to be kind of like Rosa Parks not leaving her seat on the bus. You know, it seems to have really been a huge catalyst for a fresh reexamination of interethnic relations in the United States. And as Isabel says in her book, basically we are essentially called upon to begin the process of the dismantling of the caste system in America. So that was before us as well. So the contagion, caste, climate change, I mean, each one of these taken by itself is just an enormous challenge. And the fact that we're facing them all at once, I think for me, really demands a more unified vision of how they relate to each other from the standpoint of the Dharma, and then based on that vision, how we can bring the Dharma to bear on all of them with the understanding that they are not unrelated, that to some extent they all come from the same source. So these are some of the thoughts and ideas that I want to share with you this evening. And the sort of the unifying theme that has arisen for me, I've been thinking about this stuff for quite a while now, actually. Like, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, why not start with the four ennobling truths, right? The truth of suffering, the truth of discontent, of dissatisfaction, with being unhappy with things as they are. And the cause of suffering, at least human caused suffering, in terms of the Buddhist theory of the case, is sort of craving and clinging, as the word tanha is translated. But what, as later became apparent, he really meant in his teachings, was that we want things to be different than they are. But that's the real core of this term, dukkha. We want something not present to be present, right? We want what we don't have. We want something present to not be present. So we are aversive to, are pushing away things that we find unpleasant. And then we just ignore the things we don't want it to. So that's what these three torments of the mind are: attachment, aversion, and delusion. And in this understanding, I was looking for parallels between, you know, the Buddhist teachings and some classic Western Christian teachings on the same subject. And so I looked up the etymology of, you know, the root of the origins of the word evil. And what I learned was that it comes from the Old German, which is translated as exceeding due measure or beyond reasonable bounds. So interestingly, the root meaning, or the original meaning of the word evil, was basically kind of synonymous with greed, with severe craving and clinging. And the things we know about the kilesas, attachment, aversion, and delusion, is that they operate most powerfully and effectively when we're unaware that they're in control of our consciousness. they're driving the bus without even us knowing it. They're kind of like the operating system. So one of the core purposes of mindfulness meditation is to awaken to the presence of these forces and the degree to which they're controlling our thoughts and our words and our deeds. And when we do that, all of a sudden, they're not the operating system anymore. They're an app. Right? And the operating system becomes mindfulness, right? We're waking up to the way that attachment, aversion, and delusion are coloring or forming our consciousness, are forming the way that we think, the way we speak, and the way we act. The function of mindfulness meditation is to wake up to that process, to see it going on. Once we begin to be able to see it going on, the very knowing of the presence of the kilesas begins to disempower them. Like Nalio and some others say, mindfulness meditation is in large part about watching the mind with the heart. You know, the analogy that Nalio uses a lot is like a parent watching their kids at the playground. Basically, you want to give them freedom to explore the world and be as they will, but yet without harming themselves or others. So you're watching the mind with a certain sense of kindness and self-protectiveness, you know, both for ourselves and others. And then when the mindfulness is present, it begins to drain away the power and the harm that the places can otherwise do. So where do these things come from in the first place? Within the Buddhist realm of thought and psychology. They have really innocent and in some ways vitally important and useful origins. So for those of us that we, you know, have had a chance to look at the, you know, the teaching of anatta or not self, then we know that what the Buddha taught about, you know, instead of there being a permanent abiding self, that we conjure the self on a moment-to-moment basis, right? And that there are five basic ingredients to the self when we put it together. And his definition of self is these five elements or five aggregates affected by clinging. So we have the body. We have a very highly tuned, survival-oriented sensory system, okay, it's a sensory reaction system that in this teaching is called Vedana. And basically, Vedana, I guess if you were to think about it in terms of neuroscience, there's the medulla oblongata, which is the most primitive part of our brain, and it's one that we share with almost all other beings in the animal kingdom. And it's this being able to sense that which is pleasant, that which is unpleasant, and that which is irrelevant. It happens really, you know, almost every animal in the animal kingdom will respond to positive and negative stimuli. So it's something we have in common with, you know, all of the animal world, and a lot of botanists are telling us, probably with the plant world as well. At any rate, sense input that is immediately judged to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And so Vedana, badly translated in English as feelings, which confuses it with emotions, no, not at all. Just that instantaneous response to the sense of stimuli, perception, which is the identification of what the stimulus is, association, the sankharas, where we go through the memory banks and associate this current phenomenon with our history of contact with that phenomenon, give it meaning, and then fifth, the consciousness, the ability to see the interaction of all these other things. That which we take to be self, the Buddha said, is nothing more than the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay. So it's like if you're putting together a meemac, you've got the sesame bun, and you've got the patty, and you've got the lettuce, and you've got the tomato, and the clinging is the special secret sauce, right? It's kind of sticks it all together. So there we are. There's the self, right? But this function, the Vedana, in terms of the neuroscience of the whole thing, it seems that it is so well developed because it's been really crucial to our survival as a species, you know, to be able to instantly judge whether there's an opportunity that's presenting itself in terms of some animal we want or not, whether there's a threat, some animal that's hunting us, and then everything else that we just don't pay attention to. One of the founders of the science of psychology in American academia, William James, said this: millions of items in the outward order are present to my senses, which are never properly entered into my experience. Why? Because they have no interest in me. My experience is what I agree to attend to. Only those items which I notice shape my mind. Without selective interest, experience is an utter chaos. So he's saying there are good reasons why we filter out everything that's not either pleasant or unpleasant. Okay. Because there's so much other sensory input out there, it would make it crazy. So the mind tends to focus in only on that which we want, or that which we want to avoid, and then just ignores everything else. In the Buddhist psychology, however, the understanding of this, when you hear the term ignorance, you know, greed, hate, and ignorance, or attachment, aversion, and delusion, ignorance is not just a lack of knowledge or a lack of information. It has a more active connotation in Buddhism, and it might more properly be pronounced ignorance. In other words, there is a deliberate subconscious function in the mind that does not want to see something, that wants to live in denial, that wants to live in a deluded state. And so these three functions, or this function of the pleasant, the unpleasant, the neutral, is one of the reasons we're here as a species. However, things can also go awry. So, for instance, I've used an example from my own life here in the past of being in a shooting war in Vietnam, when the senses very quickly had to get attuned to the sounds of especially things that were being shot at us. You know, whether it was bullets or rockets and mortars or whatever. So you could hear a sound and know if it was an incoming round and then get someplace in a hurry to shelter yourself. Very useful when you're at war. Coming back to the world, not so useful, because the reactions, the responses that were appropriate in combat are no longer appropriate back, you know, in civilian life. It's a fairly extreme example, but for anybody who has suffered major trauma, especially physical trauma, okay, there are what are called triggering events, a sight or a sound that reminds one of that past event, and so we react accordingly, if not appropriate, and it can create a lot of anxiety and stress if that happens. So, how did these well-intended reactions, you know, fight, flight, freeze, that's on the aversive side, right? And then the aggressive acquisition, acquisitiveness. How did these basic functions come to be, cease to be useful and valuable for our survival, and in fact get morphed into forces that can wind up actually threatening our survival instead? That's a really interesting one, I think, from the standpoint of Buddha Dharma. A few years ago, Abby and I, my wife and I, and another couple were doing a month-long backpacking tour of northern Italy. And part of the time we spent up in the Dolomiti, the Italian Alps. And they're kind of like the Rockies, only steeper. I mean, these are really steep mountains, very challenging to hike in. And then after, and this is up on the border between Austria and Italy. And so after we had been up there and we're starting down the Italian side of the Alps, we stayed in a town called Bolzano. And in Bolzano, there is this museum that has been, anthropological museum, that has been built to house Ötzi, the 5,000-year-old man. Ötzi was somebody who lived about 5,000 years ago, and he lived up in the Alps on the border between Austria and northern Italy. And he was discovered by an archaeological expedition, a team that was headed by an Italian archaeologist, also had an Austrian archaeologist and some others from other countries as well. And they discovered this body, this mummified body, high up in this really steep mountains where it was like super cold and was most of the year. And Ötzi's body was down in this deep crevasse where it had been protected from the elements for all these years, and for the most part had also been frozen solid. And so they hauled Ötzi out, and they found him just on the Austrian side of the border. But the head of the expedition was Italian. So they packed up Ötzi and they put him in their van and they went tearing down the Alps to Bolzano with Ötzi in the back. And the Austrians were really been out of shape about this. They said, you know, damn it, you know, you found them on our land, therefore it's our corpse, and we want them back in Austria because we want to build our own museum. And so they went out of hammer and tongs for a long time, and Austria sued Italy, and they got all carried away about it. And then, but, you know, finders keepers, and, you know, possession being nine-tenths of the law and all that, the Italians hung on to them. And they built this museum so you could go and have a look at Ötzi and his clothing and whatnot. Really fascinating. And they continue to study Ötzi. You know, every cell of the skeleton and what's going on with them and whatnot. They made a recent discovery just, I think, a year or two before we went to see him. His skeleton was kind of busted up. And so the assumption was that he had been hunting up there someplace because he had a bow and arrow. And the assumption was that he had fallen into this crevasse, you know, and was unable to get out and froze to death. But having a real hard look at the skeleton and the other evidence around him, they came to the conclusion that Otzi got shot in the back, that he was killed by somebody else with a bow and arrow. So even 5,000 years ago, up in the high country in the Alps, they were going at it already. They were competing for sustenance, right? So if you think about it from the standpoint of Vedna, you know, from the 200,000 years ago when we first started to think of, you know, that's about how far back we think Homo sapiens came into being. We have been very aversive to starving to death, right? Big bummer. So there's a desire to survive. And that, and the way that you survive is you follow the craving for sustenance. You know, hunting and gathering, or how you were making your way until agriculture came along. And when there is scarcity, there is competition. And so as a result of that, we had conflict arise. And that pattern seems to have kind of been with us ever since. The interesting part, I think, from the standpoint of the Dharma, is what are the circumstances under which you have two different groups, two different culture groups, who are potentially in competition for the same resource and might be inclined even to enter in a conflict with each other. But what is the impetus that can shift that from competition, perhaps deadly competition, to cooperation instead? One of the most graphic examples in our own history about that that tension has to do with when the British colonists were getting ready to go to war. The British colonists in the colonies here were getting ready to go to war with the French in Canada. The British colonists were at each other's throats. They were each printing their own money. They were taxing each other's goods at the border. They just couldn't get it together at all. Benjamin Franklin said, you know, have a look at the indigenous people, look around us, live around us. Because about 400 years before the British colonists came along, the six tribes of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, also called the Iroquois Confederacy, had also been having at each other. And they were competing for resources, and they would occasionally go to war with each other. And at some point, the women of the tribes, this is really interesting, the women of the six tribes making up the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, I said enough already. These were all matriarchal tribes. And so what they did was to designate a peacemaker from each tribe to come together into council and come to some kind of an agreement whereby, instead of constantly battling each other over scarce resources, they would instead cooperate. And they would share, if they were good hunting for one tribe and not so good for another, for whatever reason, instead of invading each other's hunting grounds, they'd share food. So the level of armed conflict went way down. The well-being of all the six tribes improved considerably. And when we were coming up on the French and Indian War, when the British colonists and the French Canadian colonists went to war over where the boundary was going to be between the two, the members of the Adenosonic Confederacy came to the English and said, you know, our enemy tribes over on the other side of the St. Lawrence and the French, they've got it kind of together. You know, if you don't, you're going to lose this war. And so Franklin used the example of the Adenosine Confederacy as a model for how to get the British to get their act together enough to fend off the French. So we've got in our own history examples of how that can be done. Interesting things for me to see about that is it was the female leaders of the tribes that did it, that made it happen. Because they saw that the survival of all of the tribes depended on their ability to cooperate with each other instead of killing each other all. So the potential for it is there, right? And the Buddha saw that potential. He offered advice on how to make that become a reality in a variety of areas. And obviously, when we look at the caste situation, when we look at the climate emergency, when we look at the contagion, we've got a ways to go. There is a lot of people, or several people in this retreat who are expressing a fair amount of despair and discouragement, you know, whether or not our efforts are going to be able to make any kind of difference. And one analogy that came to mind for me was this. You know, the way a tree works, the trunk and the roots and the branches and the foliage and whatnot, about 80, 90% of the tree mass is dead. The only living tissue is on the outside of it. The root tips, the root hairs, the bark, the cambium, the circulatory system of the tree is on the outside of it, right? There's these, the tissue called xylem. And basically, that's part of the vascular system that draws water from the roots in the ground up the trunk of the tree into the foliage where the chlorophyll is in the foliage to do photosynthesis, create food out of, you know, not going to talk about the Krebs cycle here, but create something out of nothing, it seems, you know, and send the nutrients, the growth hormones, that which the tree needs to survive and thrive and prosper, back down the trunk, right? And if you think about a redwood tree, about a 200-foot tall redwood tree, what I likened it to was if you were a cell in the xylem up near the top of the tree, and you were saying, my God, for this tree to continue to live, it needs to hold 15 gallons of water a day, 200 feet straight up. I can never do that. You'd be right. But in consort with every other xylem cell in the tree, you can. So sort of what came out of that for us is that if we think only in terms of our isolated selves, what can I do? By yourself, not too much, but all around us, there are others who feel the same way. And so coming into some kind of concord and connection with them, I think seems to be where our hope lies, especially insofar as bringing the Dharma to bear. The specifics of how we do that with regard to any of these major challenges before us, I think is our work. Is our work right now. How do we bring our knowledge of the Kalesas and their counterparts We have greed, hate, and delusion. We have generosity, kindness, and wisdom. How do we bring those three to bear on the problems that are before us in the form of what Stephanie Kauser called awakened action? So that's about as far as my notes took me today. So please, there's put a lot of stuff out there. I'd be appreciative, and I mean this, of any reflections that anyone has on what I've said so far. Any thoughts, any questions? I'd like to hear. So you can just raise your hand if you want, or you can do, you can go to participants, and there's a raise your hand button you can push there, and the little blue hand will show up on your screen. So either way is good. And Kathleen and I will keep an eye out for anyone who may want to speak. Kirsten, do I see?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, God, I'm so glad. Well, we do know that trees form communities and that they communicate with one another to protect themselves. I don't know who the writer is, but he was talking about in Africa with the giraffes, who are attracted to a certain kind of tree because the leaves are very, very tasty for them and it feeds them in the right kind of way. They start by eating away at the leaves, and the minute the brain of the tree notices this, it sends out poison. So the giraffes, poor things, can't continue eating their tree. So they wander away to another community of trees with the same experience, you know. So they have to work very hard for their food. But the trees do communicate with each other. And the larger the community, the stronger, of course, they are. So that's one thing.
Okay, thank you. I don't see Sarah Greenlee here this evening, but I know we did have, you know, whether you call it social engagement or engaged Buddhism or a social action or awakened action. I know that we have had an affinity group within our Sangha that has from time to time been active on issues like this. And I'm wondering if there's any juice among the Sangha for kind of reactivating that and using it to take a more integrated look at some of the issues before us and kind of brainstorming if there's anything as a Sangha we might want to do any of these realms going forward. Do you want to have any thoughts about that they'd like to share? A little bit like what we ran into on the retreat, which is somebody saying, great idea, why don't you get that together for us? Some feeling that maybe we're all, or, you know, even though we're spending a lot of time, you know, all alone and whatnot, that we still got pretty full plates, and maybe there's not a lot of energy or juice for something more on top of that. So we'll have to wait and see if anything unfolds from that.
Well, we can contact Sarah and see something with that. Yeah. They were working on, if anybody knows, I think they were working with homeless youths. I think you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Okay.
But I think you're having a starting group discussing the caste system would be a good way to get something going in that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, how do you want to do this? Should I wait a week or so and find out who among us has the juice for maybe getting a copy of this book and starting to read it and seeing if we want to read it together? I'm hesitant to ask for a show of hands right now because I don't know how motivated, you know, people might be to do this. And also, there are articles about the book. There's a review of the book in the New York Times today, and it's out there. It's getting a lot of buzz. And so you may want to read about the book and see if it's something that's of sufficient interest to you to get a copy of and to read. So what if I send out something in maybe the next week or 10 days to get a feeling for who might want to sign on to a reading group for that book? Does that sound like a way to go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just got my copy on the weekends or Saturday. Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Would be interested.
Karen.
Karen.
Unmute, Karen.
I can't figure out where to raise my hand so that it's on the screen. It's interesting. When you ask a question like that, this is different just for me in this time. I just feel this big dullness. I want to belong to the book group. Now that fits. But as far as awakened Buddhism, and I really like that term.
Awakened action.
Awakened action.
Yeah.
I just have this sort of heavy, confined, just, you know, difficult to respond kind of feeling about
right.
it. I think maybe the times, it may be our isolation, it may be, but just sort of a deadness in a way.
Yeah. I can hear that. And also, there are real limitations on actions we can take anyway, just because of the circumstances that we're sort of facing. And so, and as Kathleen was saying, I think maybe just reflecting together with some fairly rich thought that's presented in this book and say, oh, you know, and there are aspects of the book that I, you know, maybe are, so I'm not like a true believer. I think it's a tremendous contribution to the national conversation on a lot of stuff. And yeah, I've got some stuff that I wish that she'd added that she didn't or might have done a little differently, but you know, it is what it is. So, right, I think that's probably a good starting point, just like you said. Okay.
Dorothy has her hand up.
Dorothy, please.
Okay, there you go. No, this is about Isabel's book.
You're muted again.
Yeah.
Okay, I moved my computer closer and it jiggled. But there's been a lot of publicity about Isabel Wilkerson's book. She was interviewed on NPR, and then she was seen on TV on PBS just this last week.
Okay.
And having the book group is a good idea. And I think there's a number of us, our smaller group, has been talking about it, the one that Kathleen's involved it too. And I like the idea of reading it together, like just, you know, chapter by chapter, so we don't
to read
the whole book first.
Okay.
You know, that seems daunting.
Right.
If we could just, you know, read a few chapters and talk about that. That to me is appealing. And I bet there are a number of people here who would be able to raise their hand and say they're interested. So
yeah.
That's my thought.
Okay. All right. Well, what I can do is put the call out and maybe do it sooner rather than later. And then when I get some responses, I can organize a Zoom meeting or, you know, kind of put out that we'd like to go that route, and I'll suggest dates and times and see if people have any, you know, if we coalesce around any preferences. And then maybe we could have an organizational meeting and decide how we might want to pace ourselves, how many chapters we want to read at a time. I think that's a really good idea. Appreciate that. Okay. Gloria, I see your hand up.
Thanks, Carol Lloyd. I have a question that's been sort of bouncing around in the back of my mind since your last few talks, and that's the notion of paradigm shifts. You know, I remember when there were, that discussion was all the rage some years ago in academia, and it's an interesting one, and I'm wondering what you think from a Buddhist perspective is, so the key to moving the paradigm is to challenge the core concept. Right? And I'm wondering what you think the core concept is. So, you know, the move from a geocentric worldview to a heliocentric one was the Earth is not the center of the universe. You know, we had to get with that program, and it took several centuries. Some people weren't there. And I'm wondering what you think, given the various crises, if there is a concept that binds them together that needs to be challenged.
Right off the top of my head, the paradigm shift, you know, just like, you know, moving from a geocentric to a heliocentric perspective, I think basically what we're going to have to do, certainly from the Buddha Dharma perspective, is to bring into more complete realization on our own parts as well as others. And we are also not the center of the universe. That COVID-19 is a naturally unfolding phenomenon, and it was brought on in part by the destruction of habitat of, you know, wilderness areas in Southeast Asia. And Anthony Fauci and others are saying, you know, there's more where that came from, you know. To the extent that we keep poking the hornet's nest through the destruction of habitat, there are going to be more of these things coming our way. And I think that, at least for us, you know, here in the United States, I think that the fact that all of these things are happening at once is like holding up a mirror to the things that we were kind of making do with, kind of stumbling along, trying to keep things more or less going as they were. And suddenly, all of these combined events are basically creating such enormous combined stressors that it's becoming more and more apparent that the way our society is organized, the way we treat each other, the economic system, are all in need of a fundamental overhaul, and that without doing it in a kind of a unified and coordinated way, our days as king of the hill are over. I totally think that things are in need of a fundamental rethinking, and I think that the neat thing about it is that we can be part of that, you know, and just doing things like this, you know, getting together around this book, I think are actually part of it. You know, I can't remember the exact words of Einstein's quote, but it was something like, you can't use the same kind of thinking that got you into trouble to get yourself out of it. That there really is a need for a new way to conceptualize the situation that we find ourselves in, and therefore what some of the ways to remedy it or to reform it might be. Absolutely.
Thank you.
I think I see Ken's hand up.
Yes. Another way that that could be framed, I think, is that underpinnings of the crises that we face are selfishness. So that, you know, if I say, well, I got enough food, to hell with you, then a certain number of the ewes on the other side of that are going to go looking for bush meat, whether that be in Africa or Southeast Asia or wherever. In exactly the same way, if I say, I have all the energy I need, and to hell with you, there will be people who will go out and do their damnedest to get more oil, more gas, to get their own source of energy, rather than cooperating on how we can get things done without each of us having to have our own pickup truck. So I think that the fundamental unwillingness to share is underlying a lot of what we have, and I think you could probably make the argument that that extends over into racial and other minority groups that are disadvantaged.
Sure. Yeah. And related to that, the theme of exploitation, you know, the institution of enslavement, you know, 400 years ago in this country, it was the exploitation of an entire group of people in order to get cheap labor to build the economy. And in the same way, it's the exploitation of the natural environment, especially with regard to fossil fuels. That is one of the things that is posing the most direct threat to the well-being of all of humankind right now, right? And the inability to see the need for cooperative action to get us out of this. But I think awakening is happening, and, you know, we're invited to be part of doing that. Anybody else want to chip in? Very well, friends. I think that it's been, you know, it's been a long weekend for me. I really like the fact that we had a chance to share some of our thoughts and reflections, and I'm looking forward to, with all those of you who might want to be involved in doing so, to going through this text together, seeing what we might learn from it, and how we might put it to use insofar as the Dharma practice is concerned. So let's settle back in for just a moment, if we can, to our sitting posture. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Vala Tusava Mangalam Rakam Tusava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sāvā bhūtā nirbhāvena sāla soti bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Sāvā tirsāvā mangalam rākantu sāvā devata. May there be every blessing, may all the devas protect you. Sāvā dhamma nirbhāvena sāvā soti bhavantute. By the power of all the dharma, may you always be well. Sāvā tu sāvā mangalam rākam tu sāvā devata. May there be every blessing, may all the devas protect you. Sāvā sāṅgā māṅgālāṁ rākam tu sāvā devatā. Sāvā sāṅgā māṅgālāṁ sāvā sote bhavankate. By the power of all the sāṅgā, may you always be well. Sāvā tu sāvā māṅgālāṁ May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Have a good week, everybody. Stay safe and be well.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Same. Tara Lloyd. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you.
You bet. Good night.
Hey, Lloyd, what would you like to call your talk?
Oh, gosh. Okay. The Kalesas and Awakened Action. There's only half a talk. I know you're sure we need to keep this one on the books. I don't know. Sure. Yeah, let's put it up there. They get some wheels turning anyway.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Good night, you all.
Good night, everybody.
Bye. Thank you,
Lloyd. We'll be in touch.
All right. Have a good week, everybody. Here we go.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Bye.
It's a new kind of summer, but it is summer. Find exceptional offers at the Infinity Summer Event and experience Infinity Now. Service, test drives, purchase and lease.